The podcast of Sending It on John Boats is starting right now. Hello and welcome, welcome and hello. We're going to be covering another one of our very popular YouTube videos on this podcast. We're going to go through the comment section and answer not all the questions, because this one's got a lot of them, but we're going to go through and answer as many of them. So if you're not familiar with our podcast, what we do is we take some of the popular videos that are on our YouTube channel where we did different things on John Boats. And because there's just so many comments, I don't have time to really respond to every single one of them. Sit down here and podcast and talk about it for a little bit. Try to answer as many questions and go through as many comments as we can. And a video that we're going to be covering in this episode is the John Boat electrical wiring for beginners and DIYers. Wiring for DIYers. That turned out interesting. I didn't notice that. Anyways, this video was filmed 3 years ago. It's got 445,000 views and 932 comments. Doubt we're going to make it through all 932 on this episode, but I'll try to get to as many as possible. And for those of you who are just finding the podcast, have never actually watched the video, what we did is on my 1648 John Boat, I was going through the process of installing everything electrical and breaking it down, making it as simple and easy as possible for people to understand. We installed a battery on-off switch. We installed a battery wiring. We installed a circuit breaker for the trolling motor, a six-pin fuse block or a six-circuit fuse block. We installed a switch panel and showed you how to wire it up. We actually took the wiring that was originally on a switch panel that came with it and got rid of it and did custom wiring on it. We did a front nav light, a rear nav light. Both of those were LEDs. We did some front headlights, like some light LED light bars. And then we did some like under the deck lighting and under the catwalk lighting to kind of help light it up at night. Made a cool little, you know, like panel to go inside the boat to hold all of the electrical panels and accessories and all that kind of good stuff. So it was a very basic video. It's just a walkthrough for people that are new, that are thinking about getting into John Boat wiring or thinking about wiring their own John Boat and just needed somewhere to start. So that's kind of what this video was. And not to toot my own horn, I thought it was a pretty good video for beginners. So if you have not watched the video and you're thinking about getting into John Boat wiring, I'd highly recommend go watch that. There's a lot of other YouTubers that have done similar videos, and they also do a great job as well. So if you want to go check those out. And before we jump into the comments and start answering some questions, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this podcast. That is going to be TTP Outdoors. And no, Scooter, TTP does not stand for teeny tiny popcorn. And no, Kevin, TTP does not stand for Twinkies, Twinkies, and Pickles. TTP stands for Twitch, Twitch, Pause, and they are a super awesome American clothing company that makes some stuff that I'm actually wearing tonight, because I actually remember to wear it for once. They make really awesome fishing gear. Absolutely love it. It's super comfortable. It's got that like very soft feel to it, almost like silk, but it's not silk. All the shirts that I've gotten from them, it's super comfortable. They got some really cool hats, more hats here, and all kind of different patterns. They even have an old school Bottomland hat that matches my boat. And they make a Bottomland shirt, which also matches my boat. And I really like that. They have a lot of variety of sun shirts that are UPF rated. I can't remember how the rating scale goes. I think it's like zero to ginger. So if you have a skin tone that looks like Dale Earnhardt Jr. or a Carrot Top, wear these shirts and keep you from getting sunburned out there in the blazing hot heat while you are fishing. But not only do they make super awesome fishing clothing, they also have a coupon code for you guys. If you want to check that out, it is down in the description box below. And if you're watching this on YouTube, it's right in here in the bottom of this screen. You can use that coupon code and get 10% off your checkout at TTP Outdoors. And remember what shirt I'm wearing tonight. I don't know if you guys can see it on YouTube, but I'm wearing the, I think it's the Redfish shirt. I just kind of like this one. The only thing is it's white, so I can't wear this while I'm eating chili dogs or pizza or pretty much anything, because I would spill it. But now that my beard's getting nice and long, it actually would catch in my beard before it hits my shirt. So I may get lucky. Regardless, thank you to TTP Outdoors for sponsoring today's podcast. Let's get into some of these comments and questions. So one of the comments reads, "This video is exactly what I was looking for. Never thought about a cutoff switch to shut everything down. It's on my shopping list. You are so right about skimping elsewhere, not on marine grade wire." Yeah, so it absolutely blows my mind that people don't know about battery cutoff switches. I guess because I've been doing wiring for so long on boats, I've just always put one in and never really thought about it. But yeah, so when I install a battery, the very first thing after the battery I install is a short lead. And on a positive wire, I install a battery on-off switch. They're not crazy expensive, and there's no reason not to have one. All you gotta do is just flip one switch, that battery on off switch, and it shuts down everything in the boat on that battery. And as long as you remember to shut it off whenever you get done fishing or at the end of the day when you get back home, you never have to worry about having a battery that's going to be draining, you know, for a week or two while you're not fishing. So the other thing that you mentioned was the marine grade wire. I did like a little spiel in the video where I talked about the differences between regular copper wire, household wire, marine grade wire versus automotive wire. And there's a lot of differences, and it's very important. I work on a lot of boats that have a lot of different kind of wire in them. I've seen everything from extension cords and Romex from houses and all jumper cables, all kinds of crazy stuff. I can tell you from not just my work experience, but from personal experience, if there's anything that you want to spend your money on when it comes to wiring up your boat, the wire itself is the most important part. It's really easy to change out a cheap LED light. It is really easy to change out a, you know, a crappy nav light that you bought on Amazon. It is not easy to build your whole boat, use it for a couple months or a year, and then have a problem with wire and have to pull all that wire back through your boat to try to get it out. Because usually what happens is it starts on the connector end, whether that be at a ring terminal or a butt connector or something like that. It starts to corrode and get that like kind of bluish, greenish, whitish, powdery look all over the wire. And it travels through the wire down inside the insulation. And it, over the time, and it could be years, it could be months, just depending on what your situation is and how much water it's being exposed to. Over time, it makes that wire kind of brittle. They can break very easily. But more importantly, the powder builds up resistance in the wire until at some point the wire can't make good connection. And then you start having intermittent failures. You get it where stuff like a light flickers, or sometimes it'll shut off and sometimes it won't, or sometimes it turns on and sometimes it won't. And just, I can just tell you from personal experience, one, jumper cables suck. I actually had a battery catch on fire one time using jumper cables because they corroded. I couldn't see the corrosion because it was back behind a bunch of heat shrink. And when that wire finally moved enough, it sparked and got really, really hot and started melting the insulation on the wire. And whoosh, next thing you know, got a nice little fire. If you haven't watched the video and you want to hear the whole spiel and see the difference between the different kinds of wire and why I recommend marine grade wire, go check out the video. I explain a lot more of it in there. There is marine grade wire for a reason. It's because it's used in marine applications. Next comment says, I'm an electrician for homes and you did a fine job. Boat and automotive wiring is foreign to me. Great work, man. This is not only a comment that I've seen quite a few times on this video, but also a call that we get here at the shop a lot where people are commercial electricians or household electricians, and then they've got to wire up a boat and it's just like, boom, mind blown. How do you do it? I'm not used to it. I don't know what, because to me, 12 volt, 24 volt, 36, 48 volt, all the stuff we do in boats is super duper simple compared to wiring up a house. Now, I've done a little bit of electrical work in my life, not professionally, but like little stuff around the house. And it took me a long time and a lot of research to learn how to do household wiring. And I think it is 10 times more complicated than doing boat wiring. You know, boat wiring, it's really simple. 12 volt, everything that comes out of the battery on a positive side goes to whatever accessory you want, and it needs to end up back at the negative side of the battery. It's just one big loop. It's super simple. You put a break in between it, like a battery on off switch, put a fuse block in there. You can run inline fuses. There's a lot of ways to do it. None of them are really wrong. There's some better ways than others to do things, but to me, it just doesn't seem that hard. And I find it funny that I've gotten so many comments from people that are household electricians or commercial electricians that are like just absolutely scared of doing boat wiring. It's really not hard at all. Another comment said, I'm doing a puddle jumper build. And last week I bought a lithium battery charger, LED lighting, battery wiring, electrical connectors. I got the exact same line connectors with a solder heat shrink. Glad to see them used in a video. Thanks for the inspiration. The wiring soldering connectors that he's talking about, and I'm assuming it's he, that this person is talking about in this comment, is the heat shrink solder seal connectors. And if you haven't seen them, I'll leave a link to them down in the description box below if you want to check them out. But I used them in the video and I showed how to use them. And the reason I did it was, one, I'd been testing them out for a little while. I'd used them on a few projects on my truck and I had used it in one other boat project and I really liked them. They were actually pretty simple to use. But also there's like a gazillion million videos on YouTube showing how to use butt connectors that are crimp style. And there's even more videos about how to solder. So I didn't really feel a need to just repeat what, you know, everybody had already seen. And I think that crimps are easy for beginners, but the solder seal, I feel like, is even more easy. If that's even the right English. Yeah, it's easier for beginners because you weren't relying on getting a good solid crimp connection. And that's one of the problems that I see with people that do crimp connections is if you don't have the appropriate crimping tool, a lot of times you will have connection issues because you're not using the right tool to crimp properly. Speaking of that, what is the right tool? Well, there is actual wire crimpers and they all work great. A lot of them do. But for me personally, and what I use here in the shop is lineman's pliers. That's what they're called. You can buy them at Harbor Freight, Lowe's, Home Depot. I'm sure you can get them on Amazon. But lineman's pliers is what I like to use. It has the perfect amount of crimp for me. They're usually a lot more heavy duty than your automotive style wiring crimpers because when you're doing them in a boat, you're going to be doing a lot of crimps. And the lineman's pliers only do two really basic functions. They have a crimper and they have a line cutter. That's it. That's the only two things it has. Most of your crimping tools that you're going to buy from like Amazon, Walmart, Home Depot, Harbor Freight, places like that, they're usually multi-tools. They're usually wire strippers, wire cutters. They have a bunch of different size crimpers on there. They'll have some gauges built in there so you can tell what wire gauge. They have all this just random stuff. Like, I haven't even seen pliers built into them. And there's nothing wrong with those if you're only going to do a few. But when you're doing, an entire boat build and you're going to be using 50, 60, 70 crimps across the entire electrical system, a set of dedicated crimpers is kind of nice to have. And you don't have to go crazy. You don't have to get anything super expensive. Like, I think the two pair of lineman's pliers that we have here at the shop that I use all the time when we're doing electrical, I think I bought them at Harbor Freight and they were like $15 or $20. And I got the nice brand, the Doyle. I think it's called Doyle. It's the most expensive brand of lineman's pliers that they sell at Harbor Freight. And they're really not that crazy expensive. But back to the solder seal connectors. I hadn't had a whole lot of experience with them other than I knew how to use them and I knew how to get a good connection with them. But I hadn't had a long, usage so I could give a good review on them. And I had a lot of comments in the video. I actually had a lot of hate in the video about those connectors. And I'll be honest, me personally, after 3 years, I didn't have any connection issues with those solder seal connectors. I actually really liked them. Now, it may have been just the brand that I use. Maybe there's some other cheaper brands out there. I mean, I got them on Amazon. I didn't spend a whole lot of money on them. I got a kit for, I want to say like $9 or $10. And it had a bunch of different sizes in it. And I used all of them over, various projects. And we still use them here in the shop. You just heat, you put the wires together, make sure everything's all nice and neat, slide that heat shrink, solder seal connector over them and heat shrink it up. And they work. And I'm jumping a little bit ahead here. There's going to be a new wiring video coming out because I actually decided to rewire my entire boat. I added a whole bunch more stuff. I changed out all my LED colors. I added some new lights. I had replaced some old lights. I left some of the lights that I had in there, but I did a bunch of different stuff and most of it was involved with lighting. But while it was in there, I just went ahead and ripped out all the wires and started over for a couple different reasons. And we'll talk about that, I'm sure, at some point in this podcast. But that video is coming out. And when I went to go pull all the wires out of my boat, 3 years later, since I did this originally, there was not a single connection issue in my electrical system at all. So I'm not saying that the solder seal connectors are the greatest thing on the planet. I'm not saying that they're bad. I used them. I liked them and I didn't have any problems with them. Now your mileage may vary and that's totally okay. If you don't like them, use the butt connectors with heat shrink. That works fine too. Time to crack a nice pour. I got myself tonight some Rare Breed Rye. If you are a bourbon drinker and you have never tried rye before, this is the one that I would absolutely 150 million percent recommend that you try. I actually think I like this better than regular Rare Breed, and that's really hard for me to say because Rare Breed's been one of my favorite bourbons for a long time. But what I really like about the Rare Breed Rye is it's like a bourbon drinker's rye. It's got a lot of rye characteristics, but a lot more bourbon characteristics at the same time. And I just feel like overall, it's a great value, a great pour. It's definitely on my top four, maybe top five list of bourbon ryes that I drink. The only rye that I've ever had that's better than this one is the Jack Daniel's Single Barrel Barrel Proof. And those are still kind of spotty because I've had a couple of them that were not great. Then I've had a couple bottles of my own that were amazing. But that is the nature of single barrels. But if you're a rye fan and you've never tried a Wild Turkey Rare Breed rye, you're missing out on life. Go get you some. Another comment in here said, well done. Finally, someone who parallel connects two 12-volt batteries correctly. I will say, when I first started getting into John boat wiring or boat wiring, period, that was one of the most confusing things, was figuring out how to parallel and series batteries. And there's a lot of conflicting information out on the internet, and it's kind of hard to shuffle through it all and figure out what is what, especially when it comes to chargers. And I'll cover all that really quickly. The thing to remember is if you're going to series your 12-volt batteries, remember that You are running them in a line. When you run them in a straight line like that, which would be the first battery's negative goes to the second battery's positive, and then you have your input and output positive on the first battery, negative on the second battery. That is a series connection, and it doubles the voltage, but it keeps the same amp hour. So it doesn't give you any more actual runtime on the battery. It just makes your voltage higher. When you parallel two batteries, it's basically putting them side by side. And the way you hook those up is positive to positive, negative to negative. And I always run the positive on battery one and the negative on battery two. That way you're drawing across them both equally. But when you parallel two batteries, you're not doubling the voltage. You're doubling the size. You're making the battery bigger. You're getting more amp hours, but it does not change the voltage. Now, that's usually pretty clear cut. Most of the examples on the internet I've seen are correct, even though I have seen some pictures and wiring guides where they were wrong on the internet. So do your research and make sure you know what you're doing before you hook up batteries wrong. But where I see the most problems is with connecting chargers to series and parallel batteries. The best thing that you can do, whether you're running series or parallel, is to get a multi-bank charger and run 12 volts to one battery and 12 volts to the other battery and charge them both equally. That way you get an equal charge on both batteries and you're not trying to charge from one battery to the other battery. If you are in a situation where you can only use one charger, you need to use the charger of the voltage that your batteries are. So for instance, if you have two 12 volt batteries that are wired in series to make 24 volts, you do not use a 24 volt charger because it is going to give both batteries 24 volt. And that is not correct. You have a 24 volt output, but you cannot charge them with a 24 volt charger. What you need to do is get a 12 volt charger, preferably one on each battery, and provide 12 volts of charging power to each battery. You can, I'm not going to recommend it. I've seen it done before. You can hook one charger up to two batteries and do it that way if you want to. The way that I would do that, I would never do that. But if I were in a situation where I needed to charge two batteries, I'd probably only do it when they're in parallel. I put the charger positive lead on one battery and the charger negative lead on the other battery. That way the charge is flowing through both batteries. Or if you got like little alligator clips on there, I would put, you know, the positive and negative on one battery, let that one charge, and then put the positive and negative on the other battery and then let it charge. That's my best advice is to not do that. I would get a multi-bank charger, put 12 volt leads for the chargers on each one of the batteries and charge them individually. I actually call at the shop quite a few times where if you're running a multi-bank charger on batteries that are wired in series, do you need some kind of battery on-off switch in between the two to cut the voltage? The answer is no, because if you got 12 volts going into one battery and 12 volts going into the other and they are connected together, 12 volts is just going to run back and forth between the two batteries if it needs to. And it's not going to hurt anything at all. So I wouldn't worry about that. Another comment says, I love it when someone actually takes the time to do a clean connection and double up on the heat shrink. Super clean job. Well explained. So if you haven't seen the video, the solder seal connectors, they have the solder in the middle that actually melts and connects the two wires together, solders them together. And then it has like two little bands of glue. And the glue is used to bind the actual wire sheathing itself so that the wires won't move and the connector kind of acts as, you know, a connector, what it's for. But then it also has heat shrink built into it. So once the solder melts, the glue melts, the heat shrink shrinks it all down and makes a good, tight, waterproof connection. Now, I am a little bit weird about connections. I like to heat shrink everything, even if it's already heat shrink. Like even with heat shrink connectors, I will add heat shrink to them if it's my build, if it's, you know, customer build and we're in a rush, it's up to them whether they want it done or not. But I cut a piece of actual like black heat shrink and put it over every single one of those solder seal connectors just to kind of double up on water protection. I probably would say that's overboard. You don't have to do that. I did it just for peace of mind and I was showing how to do it on a video. And as a matter of fact, on my rewire video that will be coming out soon, I did not put heat shrink on all the connections. I did on a few of them that were I knew were going to be exposed to water. The rest of them, I just used heat shrink butt connectors. And they seem to work fine. I don't really have any issues with those. So I was probably going overboard with that, and that's okay. Not really 100% necessary, but if you feel like you want to do it, nothing wrong with that at all. And don't let anybody tell you any different. So another commenter said, great tips, very clean results. Those green manjamas were awesome. If you didn't watch the video, I did a retro TV, like late night TV commercial style intro. And not only was it funny to film, it was one of the only videos that I have ever made where I actually cracked up editing because it was just, it was so stupid. It was funny. And, you know, those old late night TV commercials are just absolutely hilarious the way that they're just like so excited about everything. And I, I actually cracked up pretty hard. I don't usually laugh at my own stuff when I'm editing videos, but that one I did. Anyway, that's what, in the video, I was wearing a, what was it? It was a Teletubby. No, not a Teletubby, a Care Bear. I was wearing a Care Bear, like, onesie. Like, you know, just furry pajamas, just, you know, kind of being funny. And, yeah, so apparently those are called manjamas. I did not know that, but thank you for letting me know. Anyways, he liked the manjamas. I like to use the adapter piece reflector nozzle that fits on the end of the heat gun to concentrate the hot air on the splice. It also helps to save you from toasting adjacent wires or overheating the insulation on the wires you are splicing. I couldn't tell if your heat shrink was marine grade. I use the marine grade stuff. It has a built-in sealer. See you on the next one. All right, so a couple of things there in that comment. First one, talking about the heat gun. The heat gun that I have has a nozzle that fits over the cone on the end of it. And I used to have a Porter Cable one. Now I have a Harbor Freight one. I think it's the Hercules brand. And they have a little metal nozzle that fits over the end of the heat gun. That it's almost like a funnel, and it concentrates the heat down into a very small area so that you can really concentrate on getting the one wire that you're trying to heat shrink, you know, shrunk down, instead of just heating up everything. And those are super helpful if you get a heat gun that has one of those. If you don't, it's not a big deal. What I kind of do is just kind of separate the wires as far away from each other as I can, and I'll heat one at a time. I have had instances where I've tried to do two, like hold two connectors right next to each other and heat them both at the same time. Sometimes they can get a little hot and stick together. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but I try to do them individually so that I know I got complete heat shrink all the way around. And then the second part of his comment is talking about marine grade heat shrink. Now, there is different kinds of heat shrink, and I'm not sure if it's actually called marine grade, but there is a heat shrink that has a, I think it's a glue on the inside. Some people call it a sealer, but to me, it looks like a heat sensitive glue. And when you actually do the heat shrink and it starts to close down on the wire, you'll see this glue heat up on the inside of it, and it starts to squeeze out the end. And it basically does. It seals the end of the connector up so that water can't get past that glue sealer or whatever and into the wire connection. So it's pretty cool stuff. I do think that they make butt connectors that are heat shrink that have that sealer in them as well. I don't buy them because they're a little bit more expensive. When I say more expensive, they may be like a dollar or two more for a 50 pack. But I don't have a like constant supply of them. We buy, like here in the shop, we buy heat shrink connectors by the thousands. So like when we order them, I'm ordering, you know, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 of them at a time. So I don't have them readily available, but I do know that I have seen them at like West Marine, and I have seen them on Amazon. So you can get them. Whether or not you need it is a whole nother story. I'm really not the expert. I've never done any testing on that. The heat shrink that I used on my boat was not the kind with the glue sealer in it, and I didn't really have any issues. But if you want to use the ones that have the sealer or glue inside of them, I think that's awesome. Every last little bit of extra moisture barrier, extra moisture protection you can give your wires and your connections, the better off you will be in the long run. So something you might want to look into. Not saying that you need to, but if you want to, you absolutely can. Another commenter said, I've been searching for hours on how to ground aluminum hull. Thank you for the big no answer. Saved my hull. Now, I'm going to do some clarification on this, because in the video, I very specifically stated that there is no reason ever that you would ground your battery or anything in your electrical system to your hull. And I still stand behind that 100%. It does some bad things if you do it. The big thing it can do is it's cause electrolysis in your boat if you do it wrong. Now, with that being said, on big boats, yachts and big offshore center consoles and lots of different styles of boats, when you get into big, huge electrical systems, they usually do run a ground from the battery negative to the hull somewhere to ground the battery to the hull. I believe, don't quote me on this, but I believe that is one of the NMMA or whatever the certification people are for marine electronics. I believe that is one of their requirements for big boats. And I think it has a lot more to do with electrical systems that are in enclosed spaces that don't get air exchange or that are reliant on air conditioning or don't have the greatest ventilation systems. Because like a lot of your bigger boats, you're going to have an engine room that has inboard outboard drives, and the fumes from the engine are in the same room as a lot of the electrical components. So they take every precaution possible to not have any kind of sparking or backfeeding and things like that. There is a way to do it properly. I don't know what the way to do it properly is on an aluminum boat, but 9 times out of 10, and in my personal experience, I have never seen a reason ever on a John boat build, or even on a, you know, a decent sized bass boat build up to, you know, 22 foot or so, that you would need to ground your electrical system to your hull for any reason. 12 volt systems and even 24 volt systems are very simplistic. And the size batteries that we're running, I mean, we're not running AC power, we're not running generators, we're not running, you know, all this other crazy stuff. We're not running up converters and buck converters and things like that. You need a basic battery, power out, power back to the battery, you have a fuse block and some switches and stuff like that. Really no reason to ground your battery or anything in your electrical system to your hull. One of the reasons that this comment got brought up, and this was not the only comment I got like this, is because in traditional automotive wiring and trailer wiring and things like that, it is very common to take the ground wire from all sorts of things, whether it be your fuse block, your battery, your alternator, your accessories like on a trailer light. All of those ground wires don't always go back to the battery negative post. A lot of them just get grounded to the car, the frame, the engine block. They get grounded to trailers and things like that. And that's where that confusion comes from. And in those systems, you're running a little bit of a different style of DC electrical power. By DC, I mean direct current. Your direct current is coming from the battery, but your alternator puts out alternating current. And in alternating current systems, or you have a generator that's powering the boat, which is basically what an alternator is, but that alternating current is what actually needs to be grounded to a frame or to a hull or things like that. In our John boats, even with a really big outboard, those are closed electrical systems that are not running AC power at all. So you don't need to ground the hull. If you want to and you want to research it and do it the right way, by all means, go do it. You need to go look into like Boat Builder Magazine or some of these big fancy yacht rigging places. I know there's a lot of forums and stuff online that talk about the correct way to do it. But in the boats that I build, the boats that we build here at the shop, we use closed loop 12 volt DC power. No reason to ground the hull ever for any reason. And there's no reason to ever ground any of your 12 volt accessories to the hull ever. Moving on. Another commenter said, only change I would make is a larger fuse to the 12 volt plug on the switch panel so you can use a handheld spotlight for navigating at night. That is actually a great idea. I did not do it because I have 3 light bars, those LED like strip light bars on the front of my boat, and I use those for basically like headlights at night. I don't ever run a spotlight, and even if I had one, I don't know if I would use it at night for 2 reasons. One, when I'm running at night, I'm usually running a mud motor, and I'm holding on to the tiller handle with one hand, and I'm usually holding on to a grab bar or my seat or something with the other hand. So holding a spotlight is just not always practical. My second reason is for like 8 months out of the year, here in Georgia at least, we got bugs, and I mean bugs at night, and they're bad. We got gnats and no-see-ums and mosquitoes and mayflies and all sorts of things that have wings that like to fly up your nose hole, into your mouth, into your ear holes. So I try to stay as far away from light, if at all possible, in my boat. I catfish at night a lot, especially during the summer when it's like peak flying bug season. And I have held a flashlight while I was driving before, and I got bugs in my teeth, my nose holes, in, you know, like my hair, in my eyeballs, in my ears. And it was because they're attracted to that light. And holding that light, even if I try to hold it away from my face, in the heat of the summer, you're just going to get swarmed with bugs. Now, I put the LED bars on the very front of my boat for that specific reason. Not because I didn't want to hold a spotlight. Because any light that is white that projects off of my boat, I want it to be as far away from me as possible. So I put it way up in the front of the boat. That way I don't have to like it. And it's also one of the reasons that I redid all the electrical in my boat. Every single light in my boat is now red instead of white, because I had all white lights before, and I got rid of all the white lights except for a few, and I switched over to red because red does not attract bugs nearly as much. And because my days are always so busy, I find myself fishing more and more at night, just out of pure scheduling. Like I just don't have time to go fishing during the day. So nighttime is the time that I spend most of my time fishing nowadays, and red has, it doesn't eliminate bugs. You're still going to get bugs, but they are nowhere near as attracted to red light at night as they are white lights. So we're going to talk about that in the upcoming electrical system redo video, but also have a separate video that I filmed exclusively about using red lights at night and showed the difference between using a white light, a green light, and a red light at night in Georgia in the summertime. And you can see the difference in the bugs. So I did it actually as an experiment so I could show people on YouTube that are not familiar with that, or maybe they're building their first boat. And that's always the first thing everybody wants to do. They want to light it up at night. They want their boat to look like it's a freaking strip club. You got all these like flashing lights and all this craziness and blues and reds and greens and all this other crap. Well, that's all fine and good for sitting in your driveway. It is not great for being out there on the water, especially if you live somewhere that has lots of bugs, like everywhere here in the South. For me, I feel even worse for the people in Florida and Louisiana, because they don't have just bugs. They have like ancient dinosaur bugs that are gigantic and will probably steal your wallet. And I would never want to have a white anything light in Florida or Louisiana, or hell, even in like lower parts of Mississippi too, where you got this bayou kind of marshy areas. I mean, they are, whew, that is bug heaven. And if you turn on a white light in the middle of the night, you're going to get swarmed. But yeah, but back to the comment, the 12 volt plug that I put in my boat was, in my mind, what I was going to use it for was charging my cell phone, or maybe charging a camera or something like that. So I only put like a 5-amp plug in there and a 5-amp fuse for that plug, because that's all I ever really plan on using. If I had a spotlight, I wouldn't be plugging it into my switch panel anyways, because at the time when I originally did this video, my switch panel was in the front compartment of my boat, which was absolutely stupid, and I never should have done that, which is one of the other reasons that I went back and redid my electrical system and moved all my switches to places that I actually use them. But I wouldn't have been able to plug in a spotlight even if I wanted to, because it was inside a hatch all the way in the front of the boat, and I'm standing in the back of the boat while I'm driving. But if you can find a red filter lens or one of those red caps that goes over the end of your spotlight and you want to run a spotlight at night, not a bad idea at all, like the commenter said, to get a bigger plug, bigger fuse, so that you can run one of those cigarette style searchlights or spotlights to help you navigate at night. Not a bad idea at all. So our next commenter said, completely foolish to hook the bilge pump up to a switch. If you send the boat underwater, last thing you're going to try to do is flip a switch. Next time, put a bilge pump float so it automatically turns on. Trust, I have the experience. Okay, so I'll tell you what I did and why I did it. And I'm not saying that this commenter is wrong, but I have a reasoning for doing what I did. The way that I wired up my boats, I put two bilge pumps in it. And that is one of my things, me just being me and weird. And with the experience that I've had, I always put two bilge pumps in every single boat build that I do. Generally, now, I put a manual bilge pump that is operated off of a switch, and I wire in a second bilge pump that has an automatic float built into it, but also has a manual option. That way, when I flip the switch to turn on my bilge pump, both pumps turn on. But the automatic one is always on as long as the battery is on, so that if I forget to turn on the switch, then the automatic one will, you know, once it starts to float, it'll kick up and start turning on that bilge pump. I'll hear it and go, oh yeah, I need to turn on my other bilge pumps. I'll go flip switch, turn them both on. In this boat build, I did two manual pumps. And the reason that I did two manual pumps and not a manual and an automatic was, one, because I'm cheap and that was all that I had at the time and I was trying to get this boat done. But two, where I fish with this boat is what I would consider shallow to almost no water at all. I built this boat for a purpose. The purpose was to go fishing in rivers here in Georgia. 90% of the places that I fish on the rivers where I'm at are anywhere between like 6 inches and like maybe 9 or 10 inches at the most. If I were to have some type of accident or something were to happen and my boat was sinking, it would be sinking in like the same depth that the boat is. I don't know if I could literally sink in the places that I fish. Now, I do go to some lakes from time to time, but one, I'm pretty cautious about what I do and where I go. And I tried my best to keep myself out of situations where my boat may flood in the first place. But two, I get all these people that are like, you know, you never know what's going to happen. But at the same time, my boat floor is only an inch and a half off of the hull. If I've got more than an inch and a half of water in my boat, I'm going to feel it because my shoes are going to be soaked if I'm in the wintertime. Or I'm going to hear it splashing around while I'm walking, which is going to go, oh, duh, I need to go turn on my bilge pumps because something is wrong. The other thing is, you know, I fish during the summertime, I'm usually either barefoot or wearing Crocs. So an inch and a half of water, I'm going to feel it or see it or it, at least slosh around in it and remember to go turn on the bilge pumps. I would hope I would. Now, in those rare instances where, you know, say I get into an accident and I'm knocked out. If I'm knocked out, the last thing I'm worried about is my boat sinking in 9 inches of water in the first place. So, yes, you probably should run a automatic bilge pump or at least put a float on one of those bilge pumps. And it's really easy to add a float. It's not that big of a deal. But in my particular boat, I honestly don't feel like I need it. I probably should. It's safe and I get that. And in the, let's see, it's been almost 4 years now since I did like the complete finished build on my boat. And I've only had one situation where I have ever been out on the water and I actually had to turn the bilge pumps on. And that was when I got caught heading back to the boat ramp in a super nasty storm. Now, I was only about a half mile away from the boat ramp when the bottom fell out because I saw the weather coming an hour before it actually hit. And I had already started making my way back to the boat ramp because I was like, I'm not going to get stuck out here. And it did happen. I was about a half mile away from the boat ramp and it came up a storm. I mean, the bottom fell out and it was monsoon raining. Even though I was soaking wet from the rain, riding back to the boat ramp in the middle of the night, by the way, this is like 1 o'clock in the morning, riding back to the boat ramp, soaking wet. I was barefoot and I felt the water in my boat come up to my toes. And I was like, oh, I should probably go turn on my bilge pumps. And I did. I ran up to the front, hit the switch, turn on the bilge pumps. Not a big deal at all. Had I had an automatic bilge pump, I may have not gotten to 1.72 inches of water in my boat before I turned the bilge pumps on, which ain't really a big deal. My boat rode around with a giant hole in the front of it for the first 2 years that, I mean, I pretty much always had about 10 to 15 gallons of water in my boat anyways. So it is what it is. This guy is not, or guy, gal, whoever this was that made this comment, they're not wrong. And I'm not going to sit here and justify that the reason that I didn't put an automatic bilge, that I didn't put an automatic bilge pump in there was right. I just didn't do it. And I'm okay with it. I'm going to live, I promise. But from here on out, and in all the boat builds we do here at the shop, we put two. We put an automatic and a manual. And if I need to, this guy can, you know, shoot me a message or an email if I need to make him feel better and redo the entire video and put a float in mine so that he can sleep at night. I will gladly do that. I don't want Scooter to lose any sleep over here. Another comment in here about grounding the boat to the hull, and this is actually a great point that I didn't cover earlier. It says, fine job on the wiring. Agree with the statement about not grounding the electrical through the hull, but has nothing to do with electrolysis. If any of your hot wires rub through the insulation, you have a direct short to ground with the potential for a fire if there's no circuit protection. I have seen it happen. That is a great, great point. If you have a ground wire going to your hull somewhere, and for some reason that wire gets nicked, cut, or the connector comes loose, and that wire is hot, or even the ground, and it touches the hull, especially if it's wet, you have just created a spark with a potential for a fire. Even if it doesn't, it can backfeed through the wire, melt the insulation, and start a fire. Great point that I didn't mention earlier. Good job on that one. Steve A6722, if you're watching, you're awesome. Thank you. Watching or listening, I should say, because this is a podcast, and you might just be listening to this and not watching. Now, this comment right here just absolutely brightens my day and made this video completely worthwhile, because this comment says, this video is the one that does it best. Even TB Nation and Anthony's videos all bring a confusion aspect to it all. This is thorough and understandable and great work. I am not going to say that I don't agree with this comment right here, because I don't want to hurt TB Nation's feelings, because I kind of work with TB Nation. But Mike did quite a few wiring videos and they are good. And Anthony from Brigade Boats or Top Gun John Boats has done a very good job with his videos too. But it warms my soul to know that somebody thinks my videos are better than theirs. Thank you, Mr. Whoever you are, at the 900 BOT, the 900 bot. Thank you very much. I want to print this comment out and put it on some really nice photo paper and send it to Mike and Anthony, because I think they would get a laugh out of that. Or they might not be happy with me. Either way, awesome comment. Thank you. So another comment in here about a few things we've already talked about, but it brought up some good points. It said, as someone who does a bit of automotive, marine wiring, instrument wiring, the only thing I generally do different, and this is just a me thing, I'll use glue line heat shrink, liquid electrical tape, and dielectric grease. If I can't use a glue line piece of heat shrink, I'll paint the cable with the LET, which is liquid electrical tape, and slide the shrink over it when it gets tacky. If it's a solder joint with no glue line, I'll put a little dielectric grease over it, and then when it gets tacky, put the dielectric grease over the joint, and then put some liquid electrical tape on the glued shrink joint. I also use the grease on all terminals I'm connecting, even auto plugs, to reduce corrosion chance. Nothing worse than going to remove a panel or fix something and everything has corroded together. Absolutely great point. And this is something that you should do and that I always forget to do when we're wiring up boats. It's not the end of the world if you don't do it, but it is a great tip for longevity, and that is using dielectric. So if you don't know anything about dielectric grease, you can find it at your automotive supply houses like O'Reilly's, Advanced Auto Parts, AutoZone. You can get it on Amazon, but it's a clear grease that conducts electricity. So it allows electricity to flow through it. It doesn't stop or, you know, add any resistance or anything like that, but it's great for putting on connections that might be exposed to water because it gives like a little surface protection. It's that little bit of grease on there. It doesn't take a lot. It's a very, very small amount, just a fine film of grease. A dielectric grease is all that you need for these kind of connections. And this is a great point. I always forget to do this. And it's not the end of the world if you don't do it. Like, your boat's not going to sink and catch on fire or nothing like that. It's just that little bit of added protection to keep you from having corrosion issues later on down the road. Something that I definitely need to get better about doing. I even have like an industrial size dielectric grease container with, it has like a little nozzle squirt gun on the end of it in my toolbox here at the shop. And I have one at home. And I always forget to use them. So if you're new to wiring and you're just doing your first one, I would probably recommend that you do dielectric grease if you want these things to last long term. So another comment said, I'm 53 years old. For years, I've used a lighter on heat shrink tubing with mixed results. Since my viewing of this video, I'm now the owner of a brand new heat gun. My pragmatic side wants to say thanks. My ego wants to tell you something else. You taught an old dog a new trick. So in this video, I did get quite a few comments about this. People were hating on me when I talked about not using a lighter to shrink heat shrink tubing. And while I'll admit the way that I showed it in the video was a little bit dramatic, I actually held the heat shrink down onto the flame. This was a basic beginner's wiring video. And I see people do this all the time, not just on YouTube, but I've seen people do it in person in shop. I've seen people do it on their own personal boats when they bring them in. It's kind of natural when you first start wiring to want to hold the heat shrink in the flame of the lighter, and it damages the heat shrink if you're not careful. And there's a proper way to do it. You can do it with a lighter. You can hold the lighter a little bit away from the heat shrink and just let the heat get up to it. But my problem with it is, one, it takes too long, and two, the end of the lighter gets so freaking hot, you always wind up setting it down on something and melting it, or you touch it wrong with your finger and then you get a nice little burn on your finger. A lot easier and probably the proper way to do it with a heat gun, like I said in the video, and that's the way that I would recommend people do it, is use a heat gun. If you want to use a lighter, you can. You're going to be fine. Just don't put the lighter in, like, the flame itself in the heat shrink. That's no good. Don't do that. So another comment in here asking about, how do you know what size fuses to put in your fuse block? There's quite a few different ways that you can do this. The simplest and easiest is when you pick out your accessories that you're going to be putting in your boat. Like, let's just say a bilge pump, for instance. When you go to buy the bilge pump, usually in the description on most websites, it's going to tell you what the amperage is that particular bilge pump pulls. Same thing for LED lights or navigation lights, light bars, things like that. Usually either on the manufacturer's website or on the website of wherever you order it from, they're going to tell you how many amps that thing pulls. So on most of your bilge pumps that are, say, 1,500 gallons and less, they're going to pull somewhere between 3, 4, maybe 5 amps at the most. What I typically do in those situations where I know what the amperage is I pick the next highest fuse up from that particular amperage. So on my bilge pumps, for instance, in my boat, they said they were rated at 4 amps. That's what they pull. So I put a 5-amp fuse on each one of those bilge pumps. If you're running two bilge pumps on the same circuit, like I did in my boat, if you're running two bilge pumps on the same exact circuit and they each pull 4 amps, I just go ahead and put a 10-amp fuse in there. Now, if you run across an accessory that you can't find the amperage for, or you know, like the manufacturer doesn't specifically say, there's a couple different ways you can figure it out before you go to install your fuses in your boat. One is, if you have a lithium battery that has a Bluetooth function in it to where you can hook up to an app, most of the lithium battery apps these days will tell you how much amperage a battery is pulling. So what you can do is connect your Bluetooth to your lithium battery on your phone and pull up the app, and then just take your two leads from, like, say, a light bar or something, and plug it to, you know, just kind of touch the negative and touch the positive on the battery. Look at the app and it should tell you exactly how many amps it's pulling. And then you can just kind of figure out what's the next size up from there. You know, say you touch it to the leads and it's pulling 7 amps, I'd go ahead and put a 10 amp enough pews in there. The other way that you can figure it out is you can basically do the same exact thing if you have like a lead acid battery or AGM battery or a lithium battery that doesn't have a Bluetooth app. You can hook your light or bilge pump or whatever it is up to the battery with some little alligator clips, or if you want to put some ring terminals on it and hold it on the battery, you can take a multimeter and put it on the amperage setting and touch the two wires. That will tell you how many amps it is actually pulling, if you have a multimeter that is capable of doing that. Most of the time, though, in all reality, you're going to be able to find on the internet somewhere where they tell you what the amp draw of whatever it is that you're using actually does. And I just try to go a little bit above that next size fuse up. Now, on trolling motors, a little bit different because you're not using a fuse, you're using a resettable circuit breaker. What I do is kind of go the next closest, but a little bit above that sometimes, because a trolling motor, let's just say, for instance, like a 35-pound or a 45-pound thrust Minn Kota, like a clamp-on style trolling motor, they're going to pull somewhere between, you know, 35 and 40, maybe 42 amps. You can stick a 50 amp breaker in there if you want to, and there's nothing wrong with that. That is probably the correct way to do it. But if you ever get into a situation where you run up into the mud and your propeller is just running in the mud on your trolling motor and it starts to build up amperage because it's trying to overcome the force of that mud, you may pop a 50 amp breaker like really, really fast. The trolling motor and your wiring, as long as it's up to snuff, can actually go a little bit beyond that. So in my case, I usually start at 60 amps for a circuit breaker in most all trolling motor setups, because like a 40 or 35 pound thrust trolling motor that, yeah, it may max out at 42 amps. That may be what it draws at full speed. The wiring in that trolling motor can handle 60 amps, no problem. So let's go ahead and put a 60 in there just in case I hit a stump or run into the mud or whatever. It can handle a few seconds of getting close to 60. The other thing that you have to remember is these circuit breakers. I don't know many of them that are made here in Americaland anymore. Most of them are all made in the land of sweet and sour chicken. And I have seen a lot of variation in the actual amps that trips the breaker. We install a lot of them. Every single boat that comes through this place gets a circuit breaker for a trolling motor. I can't remember the last time we built a boat that didn't have a trolling motor on it. So literally we install a lot of them. And I've seen some that were rated at 50 and they would pop at full speed on a trolling motor. Now, is that going to happen to every single one of them? No, but the quality control from a lot of these places is not what it used to be back in the day. So I always go just a little bit above just in case it's not really going to hurt anything. But that is how I choose my fuses. And we got another comment in here asking about the wiring chart that I talked about in the video, and was asking about, you know, picking wire sizes. Now, one thing I did not mention in the video, and I should have clarified this more because this is kind of important, but it's also, well, I'll explain it. So the wiring chart that I described, if you go on Google and you search for marine grade wire size chart or marine grade wire chart, you're gonna get a bunch of charts. They're gonna be 12 volt, 24 volt, 3% drop, 10% drop, doesn't matter. Whichever one you pick, use whichever one fits your boat. I usually use the charts that say 12 volt critical voltage, 3% drop, because that's like the highest standards for picking your wiring. And the way that you read the chart is on one side of the chart, up and down maybe, or sometimes it's over the top, it's going to have your amperage, or, you know, usually divided up in fives and tens. So you may have 5 amps, 10 amps, 15, 20, 25, and so on down the list. And then on the opposite side of the chart, running the other direction, whether that be vertical or horizontal, it's going to have your length of wire run. Now, a lot of people mess up on this particular part right here, because the length of the wire run, and it says this on most charts, but not all of them, the length of the wire run is the distance from the battery all the way to whatever it is that you're trying to power, bilge pump, lights, light bar, nav light, anything like that. So from the distance from the battery on the positive side all the way to the light bar, and then from the light bar all the way back to the battery. So you got total round trip distance, not one-way distance. And I see a lot of people make that mistake. Not so much in small electrical stuff like lights and bilge pumps and things like that, because they don't pull a lot of amperage. Most of the time when I see people make these mistakes, it is in trolling motor wiring. There is a huge difference in the wire size that you need to run 20 feet from the back of a bass boat to the very front of a bass boat than it is to run from the back of the bass boat to the front where the trolling motor is and all the way back. That's 20 feet versus 40 feet. And that's what the wire chart is rated for, is the round trip distance. And the reason that they rate these things is for safety. The wire size, the smaller the wire, the less heat it can handle. You don't know this, electricity generates heat. And that's usually what kills wire, is heat and corrosion. But heat is what will melt the wire and actually cause fire and damage. So these wire charts are rating the wire for how much amperage they can handle before they become dangerous and overheat. So for instance, on a 15-foot wire run of trolling motor wire from the battery to the trolling motor may rate it for like 8-gauge wire. And that's totally fine if that's the only run that you're doing. But you have to remember that rating is for the round trip distance. So 15 there and 15 back is 30. And if you're pulling, 50, 60 amps through an 8-gauge wire that's running 30 feet total, you may or may not run into some problems. And usually the wire size is going to be much, much larger, something like 4-gauge or 2-gauge or maybe even, single aught or double aught, depending on how long you have to run it, how much amperage you're going to be pulling. Now, I did not explain this in the video well enough, and I will make sure to do that in future videos. Here's the thing to remember, though. Most of the electronics in your boat, that's going to be your graphs, radios, lights, light bars, the little party lights, accent lights, your nav lights, your bilge pumps, most all of that stuff is very, very low amperage. And by low amperage, I mean usually less than 5 amps, most of them less than 10. On those kinds of accessories, you pretty much can run the entire length of the boat and back on most of the boats that we build, small John boats up to mid-sized bass boats, with 14-gauge wire. My boat only being 16 feet and the length of wire that I had to run was generally less than 10 feet in most cases, I was able to get away with 16 in my boat with no problem. There were a couple of things that were a little bit further away from the battery that I probably could have gone 14, but I don't run them a whole lot, so I just stuck with 16 and everything. Now, when we build boats here at the shop, we go by the wiring chart. I check it on all the accessories that we sell and that we install, and 9 times out of 10, 14 covers just about everything except for the trolling motor wiring. Trolling motor wiring, we usually start at 6-gauge. Like, we don't even stock 8-gauge for trolling motor wiring. We just instantly go to 6 because that's the bare minimum. And when we start getting runs over, 10 feet on bigger trolling motors like Garmin, Kraken, the Force, the Lowrance Ghost, and the Minn Kota Ultras and Ultrexes and things like that, we really start paying attention to that wiring chart and make sure that we're using oversized wire, because I don't want to ever have a boat that came out of our shop that got involved in a fire or had a wire melt because we put the wrong size wire in there. So that is the easiest and simplest way to make sure that you're putting the right size wire in your boat, is to go based off of what that wiring chart says. If you're kind of, I had a couple of accessories that only pulled like 2 or 3 amps, and I was going to be running, 15, 20 feet, and it said I could have used 16, but at 10 amps, it said to go to 14. In most cases, I would probably just go ahead and step it up to 14 just to be on the safe side. And the difference in price between 14-gauge wire and 16-gauge wire is so minimal. I pretty much just use 14 on just about everything in my boat. Only on very small stuff will I use 16 anymore. Like LED nav lights, they pull like a half an amp, 1 amp, if that. Small little LED courtesy lights pull very little amperage. So most of the time I can run those on 16, but we keep 14 here in stock at the shop, and that's what I use the most of. And if I was building a boat in my garage, I would order, whatever size wire I needed for my trolling motor, probably 6-gauge. And then everything else in the boat, I probably just order 14. And run everything with that. The only exception to all of that is graphs. There's a lot of different opinions on the way that graphs need to be wired. And the industry standard has become 10-gauge minimum on just about everything with graphs, black boxes for live scopes, your 360 wiring and stuff like that. Pretty much everybody starts at 10 and goes up in wire, or I should say down in wire size from there. But the physical size of the wire is bigger, but the number of the wire gets smaller. Most, harnesses and stuff that are made, like Seaclear and I don't remember who else. There's a bunch of name brand harnesses out there. Seaclear is the one that I'm just most familiar with. But most of those harnesses use 10-gauge graph wiring. Now, what cracks me up about this is I understand the purpose behind it. You want to get as much electricity flow to your graphs as possible so that there's no interference. There's, ample electricity going to your graphs, so you're not, running low on voltage. There's a bunch of reasons for it. But here's what absolutely kills me. Most graphs, actually every graph that I have ever installed, and I've installed some big ones, 16s and 15s and all these big, humongous graphs. I have never in my life seen a graph with a stock wiring harness that actually plugs into the graph with a wire size bigger than about 20 gauge. I mean, they're teensy, tiny, itty bitty little wires. And then if you go and look up the amp rating of most of these graphs, most of them have 5-amp fuses in line built in. Very rarely do you see one over 10. And it absolutely kills me that people think that you need to run this gigantic wire all through your boat for an itty bitty graph that pulls 3 amps. I don't get it. You know, 10 gauge wires rated for really, really high amperage. Some of them 20, 30, sometimes even 40 amps at short distances. I could do a whole entire video on graph wiring because there's a million different ways to do it. And there's a lot of opinions out there, and you got outboards that can create interference and running electrical wires too close to power wires for your charging system and running the wires too close to your trolling motor. There's a bunch of different ways that you can pick up interference and have problems with graph wiring. We will save that for another video because that is a whole bunch of opinion. In my experience, we put 10 gauge wire in people's boats because that's what they expect. That's kind of the industry standard nowadays. My personal graph in my boat, I have a Hummingbird Helix 7 GPS, I think is what it's called. But it's got like auto chart and all that kind of stuff. It's not a fancy high-end graph by any means, but it does work and does do everything I need to do. I use 16-gauge wire on it, and it works fine. I don't have any interference, and it runs in a big wiring harness with a bunch of my other wiring. My transducer wire runs with a bunch of other wiring and a wiring harness. I don't have these issues. So somebody walks in the door and they want a graph installed, we do 10 minimum. That's where we start, and it's up for debate on whether that's actually needed or not. That's kind of what people do these days. Yeah, good luck figuring that one out. If you go to research that, you're in for some reading because there is a lot of opinions on what is the right size wire to use for graph wiring. So I got another comment with a question about switch panel wiring. So I watched your video twice, curved through it a third time. Here's one thing you didn't specify unless I missed it. All of the negative connections that are daisy chain on the rear of the switch panel, where do they end up going to? On the switch panel, each individual switch has 2 grounds and 3 positives. I'll explain what the positives are in a second, but this question is specifically asking about the negatives. So your ground wires or your negative wires on each one of those switches, there's 2 on each switch because you have 2 different grounds. You have a ground for the main light that when you actually push the button, it turns on and illuminates to let you know that whatever switch you just hit, it is now supplying power to that accessory. And then there's a secondary light at the bottom of the switch, and that is like a courtesy, easy to find kind of light to let you know. So when there's power going to the switch, it's just a small courtesy light at the bottom so that if you're in the dark and you need to find your switch panel, you can see those lights. You know, they're real small. They're just kind of illuminate there and you can go over and touch whichever one you need to turn on your accessories. But because those lights are separate, you need 2 different grounds for those lights. And that is what you are grounding those switches for. Now, those LED lights that are in those switches pull so little power that you can connect each one of them. So I just daisy chain them one to the next, to the next, to the next, and just kind of use those little female spade connectors, put 2 wires on each side and just run them one into the other. I get all of those ground wires over to one end and I run one black ground wire from the end of that daisy chain all the way back to the fuse block. And I just put it on one of the negative posts on the fuse block. If you're running a small fuse block, like a 6-pin, like I used in this particular boat build, and all of your negative posts have been used up on your fuse block, you can double them up. There's nothing wrong with that. And that's what I did on this particular boat build. I tied all those grounds together, daisy chained them into one ground wire, ran it back to the fuse block. I just picked one random one. I don't even know which one I picked. And I doubled the 2 ring terminals up and put them on top of each other, put that little screw in so that it holds it to the negative post of the fuse block. And that's what I did. Now, those 3 positives or 3 power, what are those things called? The little spade connector deals on the back of the switch. You got 3 of them because you have 3 different functions. You have power going into the switch, and then you have the switch itself, which, you know, allows that power to either stop right there, or if you turn it on, it'll allow power to flow through and go out to your accessory. And then you have the power for the lights. Now, the lights are 2 separate entities, if you want to call it that, but you have the courtesy light, which is what that pin is for, that 3rd pin. It's usually on Nylite style switches and all those basic rocker style switches. It's going to be the bottom right-hand pin if you're looking at the switch from the back. But that pin that you put your spade connector on is for those courtesy lights on the bottom. You don't have to use those if you don't want to. Now, the other 2 pins, the on the right-hand side, or on the left-hand side, if you're looking at the switch, the middle pin and a bottom pin, That's going to be your power coming in. That's going to go from your fuse block to that switch. And then on the opposite side, usually the top one or the middle one, is going to be the power going out to your accessory. On some switches like the Nihilite, it's actually reversed. The pin on the bottom is the one that goes out to the accessory, and the pin in the middle is the one that is the power coming into the switch. You just have to look at your individual rocker switch and see which one it is. So you don't have a choice but to run power from a fuse block to the switch and then from the switch to your accessory. Those are not optional. The one that is optional is just that little courtesy light. Now, the reason that you don't need a fourth power wire for the main light is because the switch actually runs power from the fuse block pin, the power coming in through that LED light on the big main LED light. So that when you hit that switch, the power is running through that light, actually turning that light on and sending power out to your accessory. So that's why you got the three there. And if you're running a fuse block, there is no reason to daisy chain any of those lights together. What I do is when I run my positive wire from the fuse block up to the switch on the input pin, the power going into the switch, I will put a short little, maybe 2 or 3 inch piece of wire into that connector. And then I'll put another, what are those things called? It's getting late. I'm starting to lose it here. The fuse pins is not what I'm talking about. Spade connectors. I put another female spade connector, basically creating a one-time daisy chain from the main power wire over to that courtesy light. That way you're getting power from the fuse block to both of those at the same time. And then that extra pin on the Nihilites that we use in the bottom left-hand corner, that's where you're going to plug in your power wire from your bilge pump on one switch and your nav light on another switch and your anchor light on another switch. But that's how it goes. And I explain all that in the video up close so you can see and made it as easy to understand as possible. So if you want more detail, you can go check out the old video there. Had another question here asking about onboard chargers and how I wire them up. I'm going to do a video on that in the future, but real basic for my battery setup, I have one charger I ran two 12-volt batteries in parallel for a total of 200 amp hours in my boat, and I run individual chargers for each battery. I have a quick connect plug on one battery that goes to one charger, and I have a quick connect on the other battery that goes to a second charger, and I plug both of those chargers into a 110 volt outlet and I charge them that way. If you want to get fancy and run a multi-bank charger, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I think they are great. They're just a little bit more expensive, and I am cheap. I like to do things on a budget, so I ran two very cheap budget-style chargers, and that works perfectly fine for me. Again, I've got a video coming up all about how I did the charging system in general, because I got a lot of questions in this video and through email, and I had a couple people call here at the shop asking about installing chargers, so I'll show you guys the way that I did it on my particular boat. Do that in an upcoming video coming very soon. I had another question, and this is going to be the last one I'm going to do for this podcast. The question is asking about marina mooring, where if you have a boat that stays at a marina or a boat slip, talking about keeping the bilge pumps on. So what the question is, do you hook an automatic bilge pump up directly to a battery is what the question is actually worded kind of funky, but this is the gist of the question is, should you run it straight to your battery? The answer is yes, no, maybe, kind of. It really depends on your situation. So for me, in my particular instance, my boat stays under a carport style lean-to, like one of those pop-up style ones, all year round. So I really don't have to worry about a ton of water getting in my boat. I do get some water in my boat when the rain comes in sideways, but I always leave the drain plug out of my boat when I park it for an extended period of time. So I don't really worry about having my bilge pumps hooked up to an automatic switch and hooked straight to the battery. The thing with running your bilge pump straight to your battery is if you go out of town on vacation or something and your battery is hooked straight to the bilge pump, there's no switch in between, or you got it on separate from your battery on off switch. If it comes up a big storm for, 2 days while you're gone and your bilge pump is just constantly running, when you get back from vacation and you want to go use your boat, your battery is going to be slap dead because your bilge pump's been running for 2 days. I don't particularly like that. And even if I did store my boat in out in a parking lot or on the side of the house or something where it was going to get rainwater in it a lot, I would just pull the drain plug out and not really worry about it getting a lot of rainwater in it and having to use the bilge pumps. Now, in a mooring situation where you have your boat parked at a slip, I would hope that you could at least have it on a lift where you get it up out of the water, pull the drain plug so that if it does get any water in it, it come out. But if you're in a mooring situation, then you kind of don't have a choice but to keep your bilge pumps directly connected to the battery. So that way the bilge pumps are always active. In case it does take any water on, you're already in the water, so you don't want your boat to flood. But in that case, you really need to run a constant trickle charge on your batteries at minimum. What would be even better is like a multi-chemistry battery charger so that it runs trickle mode if you're running lead acid batteries, or it's a lithium charger to where it can turn it off when the battery is done charging. And then as it starts to deplete, it will charge itself back up and then turn off when it's not needed. In those kind of situations, you're pretty much limited to, yes, you need a bilge pump that is automatic, that is hooked directly to the battery, and some way to keep those batteries charged, especially if you're going to be away from the boat for long periods of time. But for me, my boat, I'm not in that kind of situation, so that's not something that I personally would ever do. So I'm sure that we didn't even get to a quarter of these comments. There are so many of them in here. A lot of them were just funny and talking about the intro of the video, and some of them were just talking about Scooter Corner and all that kind of fun stuff. So I hope that I covered enough to answer some of the big questions that I got in this video. If you guys want to hear more or have me answer more questions about these on future podcasts, if you're watching this on YouTube, please let me know down in the comment section. If you're listening to this on one of the podcast platforms, my email address is on my YouTube channel. If you want to check it out, you feel free to email me, and I will be glad to answer any questions that I can get to, or if you guys want to hear me talk about this more in an upcoming podcast. Once again, thank you to all of our wonderful channel sponsors. We have Freedom Lube, like some awesome real oil for your fishing gear, and just a great oil all around, penetrating oil. It works on pew-pews and all kinds of other things. You got One Hit Wonder Paint, make awesome John Boat paint, which we will be doing a video on coming up soon on the Tiny Boat Nation channel. You got all the stuff that I use from Amazon, links in the description. And of course, TTP, old Tiny Toilet Paper, Twitch Paws. We appreciate you very, very much. All those sponsors and more, coupon codes down in the description box below. Thank you, everyone, for listening and tuning into the podcast. If you're watching this on a podcast platform, I would really appreciate it if you would rate the podcast. I'm trying to grow this thing and reach more people, because there's just not a ton of really good John Boat podcasts out there. We've got our other podcast. If you're not familiar, we have another podcast called the Drain Plug Podcast, which is me and Ryan from Tiny Boat Nation. And we talk about some of the boat builds and electric outboards and lithium batteries and some of the things that we do here in our shop, and answer a lot of customer questions. So I highly recommend that you check that one out as well. Also, one more quick little plug. If you're not familiar, we have channel memberships on YouTube with different levels of rewards for being a channel member. And the one that has been the most popular is my vlog videos. I have a blog that is available only for channel members, and I talk about the things that we do here in the shop, show some of the boat projects that we do, answer some questions. It's kind of not a daily vlog, but I try to do it every week or so, and just update people what's going on here at work and see what it is like to work in a boat shop full time. So if you're interested in that, you can go over on YouTube and check out the channel membership. Thank you all for tuning in, listening, watching, whatever it is that you did for this entire, however long this was, it felt like forever. I'm really tired. So, okay, bye.